This is Construction Law Today, the podcast of the American Bar Association's Forum on Construction Law. Construction Law Today is a podcast about current topics in American construction law. Your host for Construction Law Today is David Suchar.
Our podcast, Construction Law Today, began in July 2019 and is now in its third season. In our first two seasons, my good friend Buzz Tarlow produced 25 episodes on a variety of timely and interesting topics in the field of construction law. In our upcoming season, I expect to produce similar podcasts at the rate of about one new podcast per month. As always, we welcome your questions and comments. Please let us know what we can do to improve the podcast. The contact information for Construction Law Today is found at the end of this podcast. On behalf of the American Bar Association's Forum on Construction Law, thanks for listening. Welcome to the podcast. Today, we'll be talking about the False Claims Act, and we have a great guest today to discuss that issue with us. Chelsea Cullum is an expert witness at Vertex, a well-respected company in the industry and ABA Forum on Construction Law sponsor, where she focuses on economic damages in the government contracts and construction industry space. Chelsea, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, David. I'm excited to be here and look forward to our discussion.
Before we get started, Chelsea, can you give us just a quick summary of your background and experience?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I am an expert witness. So let me just give a quick disclaimer that I am not a lawyer. In college, I majored in finance. And so I've been working in the litigation consulting disputes field since I finished undergrad, working my way up from being an associate consultant all the way to the point where I'm now testifying as an expert on many matters. I spent my whole career here in Washington, D.C., and I like to say that I'm proudly one of the few non-lawyers in the city, and I'm currently with Vertex Companies, as you said, in our claims, disputes, and forensics group. Previously, I was a partner at Breakwater Forensics, which was also a sponsor of the forum and was acquired by Vertex in 2023. And before that, I worked at HKA and one of its predecessor firms, the Kenridge Group. And I also had a stint as an adjunct professor at the George Washington University here in DC, where I developed and taught a course called Pricing and Cost Issues in Government Contracts in the Graduate Business School.
Those are all great companies, and I've had the benefit of working with, I think, almost all of them. So you have a great background, and I look forward to our discussion. Can you tell us a bit about your role as an expert witness?
Sure. So I provide consulting and expert testimony in two primary areas. One is damages and cost issues. And the second is what I like to call procurement issues. And that's really where in federal court or in arbitration, I'm explaining to the arbitrator or the judge or jury how the relevant federal regulations and statutes are typically applied in practice. And the vast majority of my work relates to federal contracts. So specific to the False Claims Act, I calculate and rebut damages on False Claims Act cases, and I also often testify to these procurement issues.
Can you tell us, explain a little bit about the overlap between government contracts and the construction industry?
Sure. So a lot of people, I think, when they think about government contracts, they think about Lockheed Martin and the F-35s and these big defense company producing jets and tanks and weapons. But one of the things that really drew me to government contracts and keeps me interested is that it's really so much more than that. It spans, you know, every industry from heavy manufacturing to IT services, healthcare, launching satellites, and then, of course, construction. And federal funding touches so much of construction. If you think about sort of road and bridge construction and infrastructure, which we'll talk a little bit about later, to VA hospitals, to embassy construction, to military-based construction and maintenance, there's really so much there. And I work in every part of the contract lifecycle, but I have a particular affinity for the False Claims Act.
Let's talk about that, the False Claims Act. So for practitioners who work outside of DC, they may not have, for the most part, a ton of familiarity, work experience with the False Claims Act. Can you tell our audience about what the False Claims Act is and what it does?
So first, I'm going to rewind all the way back to the Civil War, because the False Claims Act was enacted in 1863. And so it's 160 years old now. It's often called the Lincoln Law. And basically, it originated when the Union Army was having problems getting ripped off by contractors. So the Union was buying gunpowder and getting sawdust. They were getting rotten food. They were getting sick animals that when they needed, you know, healthy mules and horses. And so the government's response to that was to enact the False Claims Act, or FCA, which to this day is the government's primary tool to fight fraud against the government.
So what are the primary prohibitions, things you can't do under the FCA, especially with regard to the construction industry?
In the simplest terms, False Claims Act violation is presenting a false or fraudulent claim for payment to the United States, where a claim is a demand for payment by a contractor, grantee, or other party if the money is to be spent on the government's behalf. So if we think about construction, one thing to keep in mind is that this flows down to your subcontractors. So if you're a construction company, or if you advise construction companies, it's not just the company that has the prime contract with the government that has liability or exposure in this area. It applies at all levels of the supply chain. And it is, again, the government's primary tool for enforcement. So that means the federal government, as we've talked about thus far, but there are also False Claims Act in nearly every state, and most of them are modeled off of the federal FCA.
Right. And if construction companies get in trouble for violating the federal statute, what are the damages and remedies?
So the False Claims Act provides for treble damages and penalties of $13,000 to $27,000 per false claim. So for example, if we want to think about it in the construction sense, that may be a pay application or an invoice. So if, for example, a construction company is charging the government for improper labor, every single invoice that contains that improper labor is going to be considered a false claim. And so those penalties of $13,000 to $27,000 add up really quickly, especially in addition to the treble damages. So you can really quickly get into sort of bet the company stakes. There are also administrative remedies, including suspension or debarment from performing federal work. And in some instances, there are even criminal penalties. Now, what we're talking about today is mostly the Civil False Claims Act, but I have worked on matters where people have gone to jail related to False Claims Act violations, and there are criminal penalties up to 5 years in prison.
That doesn't sound good, Chelsea. Yeah. As we're talking through what the Act itself does, I note that there are key TAM provisions under the statute. Can you tell us about what those are and what they mean?
Yeah, so key TAM is a shortened version of a longer Latin phrase, which essentially translates to he who brings an action for the king as well as for himself. And so in other words, individuals can file lawsuits on behalf of the United States government. And the carrot in doing so is that key TAM relators, or often, you know, in common parlance, we just call them whistleblowers, recover 15 to 30% of the total damages that are recovered by the government.
Why are these key TAM whistleblower regulations important to contractors?
First off, the Department of Justice publishes every year a list of statistics and False Claims Act recoveries for the prior year. And if you look at that data since it's been published, I believe over 70% of the government's total remedies come from these key TAM cases where there are whistleblowers or relators. And most often, whistleblowers are employees of the company that faces the action. The employees may be disgruntled, their concerns may have been brushed off, and now they're going to escalate to a level where the company is going to have to expend significant legal fees to investigate and defend against false claims allegations.
So this is the area that you practice in, but for the broader industry and for lawyers who are involved in it, can you tell us why we all need to be aware of the False Claims Act?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for two reasons. One, you know, federal funding trickles down to so many places, and whether that funding is provided through contracts, grants, other mechanisms, like I said before, it filters down to subcontractors. And so it's really a huge web of, you know, where federal funding flows, there can be False Claims Act risk. The second thing is that, and probably the most important thing that I think is a distinction for construction practitioners, is that the False Claims Act does not require specific intent to defraud the government. So in a typical civil construction suit, the threshold for fraud is incredibly high, requires intentional misrepresentation. And as you know, David, that's very difficult to prove. The False Claims Act standard is significantly lower than that. And the actual standard is knowingly submitting false claims, where knowingly is defined as having actual knowledge, deliberate ignorance, or reckless disregard. And so I see so many instances where the reckless disregard piece is the key, is what is knowingly under the FCA. And that, again, is where especially smaller companies and subcontractors get into sort of bet the company territory really quickly when these allegations arise.
Against the backdrop of these provisions that companies should not run afoul of, we have just a ton of money that's coming into the construction industry from federal programs. Why don't we talk a bit about some of those programs and how they may impact False Claims Act claims? So you have the IIJA, right? The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and then the BABA, the Build America, Buy America Act. Can you tell us about those acts and their impact?
I'll start with the IIJA, which was enacted in November of 2021. It provides $1.2 trillion in spending for all types of infrastructure. So the White House actually keeps on its website a relatively updated database of where that money is going. And as of January 2024, which is the latest available data, about $840 billion has been appropriated so far. And so I won't go into a ton of detail, but of that $840 billion, the largest allocation by project type is $325 billion for roads, bridges, and what are called major projects, followed by public transportation, clean energy and power, broadband and water. The majority of the money allocated is in the form of grants. What that means is the money is either sort of delegated out to the states or provided in federal grants. As I mentioned before, when we were talking about the definition of a false claim, some people may think that unless you have a prime contract with the federal government in sort of a traditional procurement sense of an actual contract, that the False Claims Act doesn't apply. But it does apply to grants too. And in fact, in the past several years, there's been a huge increase in grant investigations and false claims activity from DOJ specifically related to grants. So just because you have a grant does not mean that you are exempt from these regulations.
Got it.
And then the second thing, the BABA or Build America, Buy America Act is, you know, sort of a tuck-in to the IIJA. And that has probably the most direct impacts on construction contractors because it requires that all of the iron, steel, manufactured products and construction materials used in infrastructure products are produced in the United States. And so this is just the newest in a long line of what we call domestic preference legislation. So the Buy American Act from the 1930s still exists as well. And so that's going to be a really key statute for all this money that's flowing into infrastructure funding.
One more theoretical question before we get into how some of this works in practice. There's the concept of waivers when it comes to domestic preference legislation, so a way around the domestic preference. Can you tell our audience about that?
There are a few different types of waivers that can be granted. You know, if it is impractical, for example, to buy U.S. steel, you can get a waiver. There are three types. The first type is a public interest waiver. And so that is where applying the domestic content procurement preference would be inconsistent with the public interest. There is the non-availability waiver, meaning that the type of iron, steel, or construction materials that one needs for a project are not produced in the United States or available in sufficient quantities to complete the project. And the third one is the unreasonable cost waiver, which is that the inclusion of U.S. products will increase the cost of the overall project by more than 25%. So I guess to give a couple of practical examples of the way this might work, if the Department of State is building an embassy in the Philippines, there may be a public interest or unreasonable cost waiver in that instance for shipping U.S. steel or iron or other construction materials from the United States to the Philippines to build that embassy building. And then the second one I would say is there have been a lot of public interest stories about VA hospitals in the past 10 years or so and how they're overloaded. And so, you know, say the VA has to build a hospital really quickly in a new location to offset some of the overflow demand. If the products that are covered by these domestic preference laws are not available quickly enough to complete the project in a timely manner, the contractor may be eligible for a non-availability waiver.
When we come back from the break, Chelsea, let's talk about a bit about how the FCA works in practice and some things that construction and construction law practitioners should look out for. We'll be right back with more of the podcast. Welcome back to the podcast. So Chelsea, now we've covered the basics of the FCA and recent legislation that impacts construction. With all of that in mind, let's talk about the ways that this actually works in practice. In your experience, what are some key risk areas for false claims in the construction industry?
So I want to focus on three risk areas. This isn't by any means all of them, but the three that I want to hone in on are change orders and claims first, specifically unsupported or overstated change orders and claims. The second is prevailing wage laws. So most often in construction, that is the Davis-Bacon Act and non-compliance with those prevailing wage laws. And the third is, as we discussed a little bit earlier, domestic preference laws and violations or non-compliance of those domestic preference laws.
Let's take area one to start with. So that's unsupported change orders or claims. I saw in materials from a presentation that you'd given description of the Daewoo case. Can you tell our audience about that case?
Sure. So the Daewoo case is from 2009, 2010, and it's a huge case in my corner of the world since I primarily work in sort of the disputes area. Daewoo has to do with our first category, which is the change orders and claims, specifically unsupported and overstated change orders and claims. So this was a contract that Daewoo won for road construction in Palau, which if anyone doesn't know where Palau is, it is out in the middle of the South Pacific. So Daewoo first bid, you know, this was a competitively awarded contract, and Daewoo first bid $73 million to complete the project. The government had its own estimate of about $100 to $250 million, depending on certain conditions. The government went back to Daewoo and said, you know, it looks like your proposal is understated. And Daewoo came up a bit. And so the awarded contract price ended up being $88.6 million. So they get the award, they get on site, and Daewoo was incurring significant delays, which it attributed to humid and rainy conditions. The soils were very moist. And so, you know, essentially their position ended up being that they did not account for, or that they were not aware of these sort of jungly conditions that they encountered. And so they filed a claim under the Contract Disputes Act, which is maybe a topic for our next podcast, for 122 incurred days of delay with a total damages of $13.3 million plus future delays of 776 days and $50.6 million. So Daewoo did not use outside experts to make its certified claim calculation. Employees who were in charge of this admitted on testimony that they made no real effort to justify the accuracy of the claim for future costs. So the future costs are what end up being the problem here. And most claims that I work on, there is some element of estimated future costs, and those can be included in a claim, but they must be adequately supported and accurate.
I guess at this point, Chelsea, that this did not work out for Daewoo.
It did not. No, we're not going in a great direction. And so the Court of Federal Claims found that $50.6 million specifically was nothing more than a negotiating ploy. And so this was eventually appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And both the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit and the Court of Federal Claims agreed that Daewoo violated the False Claims Act. And so the U.S. government was awarded $50.6 million in damages plus a $10,000 FCA penalty, which was the penalty at the time.
What lessons do you think can be learned from that case, Chelsea?
So I think a few things. Always use outside consultants for your claims, people who do this for a living. Little plug for myself there, but I think more than that, even, I think it's very normal in sort of commercial business negotiations to go into something with a higher value than you think you can recover with the anticipation that that will be negotiated down. And that's a totally normal and acceptable practice in the commercial world. But when you're dealing with the federal government, that is not the case. Every dollar that you submit for payment to the U.S. government is under scrutiny, and you are certifying to the accuracy of that amount. And again, while estimates can be included and often are included in claims, those estimates must be supported by contemporaneous records and the facts on the ground.
Moving on to the second category that you mentioned, pitfalls to look out for, False Claims Act issues, that was prevailing wage laws. Let's talk about those issues and the Wall versus Circle C construction case, how that highlights some key issues about prevailing wage laws and subcontractor liability.
This is a case that has a lot of twists and turns, but essentially, the fact pattern is that Circle C Construction won a construction contract at Fort Campbell Military Base in Kentucky. And Circle C is a construction contractor based in Kentucky. And an employee relator alleged that Circle C had submitted false payroll certifications indicating that Circle C was paying the required prevailing wages under the Davis-Bacon Act, when in fact, Circle C was not actually paying those wages to the workers of its electrical subcontractor, which was a company called Phase Tech. So again, a lot of twists and turns in this case. In 2014, a judge announced that Circle C owed $762,000 to the government, which is the amount that the government paid Circle C for the electrical portion of the contract multiplied by three. So there were treble damages in this case. And specifically, the judge said that the government would not have paid Circle C for this electrical work at all had it known that Circle C was violating the Davis-Bacon Act. Now, on appeal, this was overturned, but I think what it illustrates is not only sort of the reach of the False Claims Act as it relates to the prevailing wage laws, as it relates to a prime contractor's liability for false claims as those relate to subcontractors, but also for this idea that after 10 years of litigation, Circle C was vindicated, and I believe the government had to pay Circle C, even its attorney's fees, for defending the case. But 10 years and probably millions of dollars in litigation expenses is nothing to sneeze at, and certainly enough to hopefully encourage contractors to really make sure that things are buttoned up in terms of both their compliance with the prevailing wage laws and their documentation of that compliance.
Let's move on to the final category there, which is domestic preference laws. I saw in the materials from your prior presentation, discussion of a case, UXXREL, Crest versus Masonry Solutions. Can you tell our audience about that case?
Yeah, so this is one related to the Buy American Act. And I like this one because it's an example of how companies can do things the right way. So this is from 2015 and was a relator who claimed that certain construction materials delivered to the project sites in question were provided by a subcontractor who sourced those materials from China, and thus that the BAA had been violated. And so the False Claims Act obviously comes into play here because the prime contractor allegedly knew that those materials were not BAA compliant and still used them and submitted for payment for them under the contract. And so what happened in this case was, again, the subcontractor and the prime contractor had to incur significant legal expenses, but the subcontractor was able to provide a very robust set of documents showing that the materials in question were compliant, even though they were manufactured from Chinese materials. So I won't get into too much of the details of the Buy American Act, but essentially that there was enough add-on material work done in the United States that the materials satisfied the BAA requirements, and they were not exclusively bought from China and just put onto the site. And so the court in that case dismissed the case with just not too much litigation or analysis because it found the company's evidence to be convincing. And so I think the lesson from this one is document everything, and it might save you a lot of time and money should these things arise.
As we get closer to finishing up, let's talk about some overarching principles that may be helpful to people in the construction industry or construction law practitioners who are advising companies all the time. What, in your mind, are the key takeaways in terms of actionable things construction lawyers, others in the industry should know in order to protect their clients and themselves, and in order to avoid FCA liability?
I would focus on a few things. First, to repeat what I just said, document, document, document. If it's not documented, it didn't happen. That's so, so important. Having a paper trail, I'm from sort of this background where I'm always looking for a paper trail of things. And I think that's, as we learned in the previous case, can be key to avoiding liability. And then I think just reviewing all requests for payment, checking certified payrolls. This is more for contractors themselves, but even for attorneys, it's important to make sure that your clients are carefully dotting every I and crossing every T, making sure that everything that is submitted to the government for payment is accurate. Make sure that your workers are properly classified in their categories under the Davis-Bacon Act or Service Contract Act. I can't overstate their importance. Related to domestic preference, the thing here is really just work with your counsel to determine whether you need to seek waivers if you want to use non-compliant materials. And then the biggest thing, I think, for overarching, other than documenting everything, is really read your contract, understand the contract requirements, the representations you're making or your client is making in taking a contract. If you're a subcontractor or you represent a subcontractor, pay really close attention to the FAR clauses, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, or the agency supplements or other requirements that are often just listed in a contract and not actually enumerated. So pay particular attention to those things and know what's in your contract so you know what you have to be complying with.
One final question, Chelsea, which is, you've talked about some of the important regulations and cases that talk through pitfalls and best practices. What do you see as trends on the horizon, ways in which the False Claims Act may continue to or impact differently the construction industry?
So I think a couple of things, you know, specifically related to the IIJA and the Build America, Buy America Act, the DOJ in the past several years has shown a ton of focus on grants. So a lot of the money under the IIJA is flowing out as grant money. And in the past, you know, the DOJ wasn't as focused on those areas. And the fact that we have a very heavy focus on grants right now, I think, is something to keep in mind. I think, obviously, looking for instances where non-compliant materials have been used, so those domestic preference issues, I think, are going to be, you know, they're sort of hot button and they're easy for the public to understand, right? So DOJ, if they can say, hey, we found a contractor using materials that they bought from China instead of the US, that's a really punchy news item for them. So I think there's going to be enhanced scrutiny on that in the next couple of years.
Chelsea, thank you. It's been great talking with you. I learned a lot by our discussion, and I'm sure that our listeners did too. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You have been listening to Construction Law Today, the podcast of the American Bar Association's Forum on Construction Law. All rights relating to this podcast are owned and controlled by the American Bar Association. No reproduction or reuse of this podcast is permissible without the express written consent of the American Bar Association. For more information about Construction Law Today, or if you have any questions or comments, you may contact our host, David Suchar, at david.suchar@maslin.com. Our podcast is produced with the assistance of Peak Recording Studios in Bozeman, Montana. Thank you for listening, and look for our next edition of Construction Law Today.